The Cambridge Marketing Podcast with Kiran Kapoor. Brought to you by Cambridge Marketing College. See their range of courses and apprenticeships at marketingcollege.com.
Hello and welcome. Today we're talking about all things exporting, and my guest is David Earp, who has spent 24 years working as part of the UK government's export promotion team called the Department of International Trade. David, welcome. Can we start with why companies should consider exporting?
Thank you for having me on, first of all. Why should companies export? Well, there's a very many reasons. If companies are working only in their domestic market, they're limited to the opportunities that that market presents them. So we're based in the UK, and if you look at the population of the UK, which is around 65, 70 million, against the global population, we're just 1% of the world's buying public. I know not everyone has got the buying power of the UK, but if you think about that, the market is simply bigger outside the UK. That's one of the first economic reasons. The second reason is that experience of international trade is proven to actually strengthen a company's resilience to the, you know, the ups and downs of business trends and business cycles. So one market might be in decline, another market will be growing, and so it lessens the risk. Now, whilst selling in your own market is clearly the least risky, and many people have, for instance, drawn back from dealing with Europe temporarily because of Brexit, there is a risk, clearly, of selling into international markets as well. But the overriding benefit of exporting is that you open your company to far more opportunities. You get the chance to be innovative in markets that haven't yet seen your product, and also getting feedback from those markets challenges you to develop products that those maybe more advanced markets might want from you, and that you could sell elsewhere in the future.
So is exporting just for big companies?
I think that we've had a period in my 24 years of seeing the development and the spreading of exporting to the smaller community, the smaller company community. There's no doubt about that. The government put on an excellent program in the past, which really was focused at encouraging more companies to export, and that brought out many companies that were already exporting but not really exploiting their full potential, because small companies brought themselves into the international market, like Cambridge Marketing College itself did, through using the internet. My experience goes back to the very early days of websites being brought onto the stage of commerce, and that has brought international opportunities by default, with companies experiencing, an inquiry from a different country, and then they've had to experience the trials and tribulations of exporting to that country. Sometimes they've been successful, sometimes they found it difficult. But the government picked up on this and really started to promote the development of skills in smaller companies. So I think that it's fair to say that it's not just a big company's area of activity. We have many examples of some successful niche companies who have expanded internationally. And I remember one of the first times we were presenting opportunities of selling via the internet, and this sounds very, very old-fashioned now, that the internet opened up what we described as not niche marketing, but particle marketing. That ability that you have through digital marketing to find the very smallest groupings of individuals or companies that have an interest in a particular area. And that's enabled small companies who have got a very strong focus on a specialist area to be able to sell not only to their domestic market, but actually to pick up companies and interested buyers all across the globe. And that's made life a lot easier.
Okay, so as a small business owner, I might be convinced that I should be exporting. How do I go about choosing a good export market?
That's a very good question, and one that some companies challenge themselves on. I was recently talking to one of my clients, and I asked them that question, and they said, yes, we've done some study on the size of this market, that market, number of people, et cetera, number of companies that would buy our product. This is absolutely essential. And I have the simple mantra that if you are going to choose a new market, you have to go back to the drawing board of when you first started business. So when you opened your eyes and thought, I think I could do this in my domestic country, not necessarily thinking international at that stage, and who would you ask? You'd really go and ask your friends, family, etc., are you doing the right thing? So similarly, with choosing the right market, it is about going back to these first principles of market research. And I think the marketing theory talks about three things. One is there a big enough market there? So this could be indicated by the size of the population or the spending in that category of business sector. The second is access. So how easy is it to deal with that country? So some countries are much easier to deal with than others. And the third one is, can you make a profit out of it? So those are the three key principles. Now, we do, through the Department for International Trade, work with some very clever market research organizations, and they've developed something called a market selection tool. And this has the ability to actually differentiate markets, countries, particularly, rather than cross the globe segments. And they will identify sorts of information that you would need to qualify whether a market was right for you or not. And they then present this on a grid. Now, some companies do this by putting different grading systems against different questions. But ours tends to see on two scales. One is about ease of doing business. So if you go on to the ease of doing business scale, which is sometimes in The Economist, you can choose those markets higher up the list than down the lower end of the list. The second thing is about the size of the potential market. So if you think about large markets, you'd be thinking about the States, you might be thinking about China and India. But actually, if you look to ease of doing business with those countries, obviously for English-speaking nations, dealing with America could be easier than dealing with China or India, for instance. So that's a way of doing it. And you can easily develop your own scoring system and build in factorization to make it more scientific, let's put it that way, to differentiate between those different sort of categories.
Okay, so that makes it all, as you said, I'll use your word scientific. So there's quite a sort of scientific method. And yeah, it's quite interesting that you basically you look at the world and you can split it down into three ways. Is it big? Is the market big enough? Is there access? And of course, finally, can you make a profit, which is only something that you as an organisation can work out. So what's the biggest mistakes that you see companies make in exporting?
I don't know that there's any one biggest mistake. There's always lots of mistakes. We've experienced lots of things, I think, through the programs that we offered when we got people coming to our webinars and seminars, and people who went out on a holiday and thought it would be nice to export to these countries because they maybe bought a holiday home or something like that in those countries. So the thing is, I believe that you should be thinking about this on a strategic viewpoint. So there are countries clearly using the ideas I just said about whether it's easier, whether it's more challenging, whether it's big or large. If you're a starter at exporting, it's probably the most simple to find a country that's nearby that you have some good experience about, or people in your organization speak their language or know something about how that country works in terms of business. So that would be the first thing. Big mistakes are people try and assume that what is happening in their own market happens also everywhere else. We look at big companies and we think, okay, we go abroad in all manner of countries across the globe, and we see the big national in multinational companies doing what looks like the same thing, but behind the scenes, it's not always the same. You take a company like McDonald's, and you know they're very well known, but around the world, their model is slightly adapted to reflect the local customs. So I think what's important is that a company selling into another market has to understand the motivations of the buyers in that country. And that could be quite different from their own domestic market. Interesting, I was looking last night at the one example was in India back in, I think it was 2009, 2008. Tata brought out the Nano, which they anticipated was going to be, you know, like the first upgrade from a scooter and motorbike for the Indian population. They also
yes, it was a really
hoped
cheap
that it
car,
would be
wasn't
for
it?
Export.
Yes.
Yeah, 2.5 thousand, well, one lakh for a car, £2,000. And they targeted to sell to 250,000 a year. But in fact, they even got it wrong in their own market, because the highest sales in one year was 74,500. And no export market took it. Why? Well, because in India, it was seen as a poor man's car, because they could buy second-hand cars for more money, and they had a higher status than a Nano. But abroad, no one wanted to buy it because it didn't pass any crash test. So, you know, even Tata didn't make a very good move with that. But that's a specific example.
There's the lovely example in the same marketplace of IKEA opening up in India, in Hyderabad, I think, and having to completely change the way that they sell things. So there's a lot more lower price points because Indians do like a good bargain.
That's correct. That's, you know, again, it's the motivation of the customer. What is it that they're buying? What is it that they value? You know, in the UK, because we're in the UK, IKEA probably, and perhaps through the rest of Europe, IKEA sort of the value to people is that they can get an instant house and do it themselves, and it's not so expensive, and it's rather minimalist and fancy. But that's how UK, you know, Europeans are motivated. Also, you know, the whole thing about, we go through cycles of trends and fashions. What happens to be fantastic in the, you know, in this part of the world may not have caught on yet somewhere else. There's some examples of where Tesco were trying to sell into the States, and they just didn't compete. The same in, I think, in some European markets. And I remember in the late 90s, mid 90s, I was in Poland, and Tesco had bought into a supermarket chain there. But what they didn't understand that was that there was no mentality of buying like a month's groceries in one go, because people didn't have that sort of money. So the initial uptake of their trade was not so successful. And they also didn't understand that there was lots of small traders. Again, similarly in India, they've been protected from the big supermarket chains. Because the government didn't want to, put all the small mum and pop shops out of mm-hmm. business by letting big supermarkets come in and take over mass retailing.
So I'm getting the impression that one of the biggest mistakes you could make in exporting is either just sort of thinking, oh, this would be a nice place to go and to export. But actually, there's also a huge amount about just making assumptions about a marketplace.
Making assumptions is, we know what people break down the word assume into. And it is clearly not, the mindset is completely different. I'm minded to think about my experience in China, and their thinking patterns are completely different to the UK. We think we understand them, but honestly, it's not that simple. You could take, for instance, if you read people like Hofstadter, for instance, they give very good generalizations of how people interact with each other across the globe. But there's no real standard way of understanding this, and unless you get, the full nuances of the country. I've studied languages in the past. I've recently learned Italian, but actually learning a language is not the same as living with the language and living with the people to understand the way things work. And culture is something that underpins the whole of a nation's way of life. But you see this, it's lying there underneath, whereas on top, people talk of popular culture. Popular culture might just be, pop tunes and stuff like that. But culture seems to have a little way of anarchically changing how things are. What we did as youngsters was completely alien to our parents. And this goes on, this cycle goes on. And, technology also influences the way things get done. We think it's very easy to send a message, for instance, via email, or send a direct mail request to someone and saying, our product is fantastic. Why don't you buy it in your country? Well, the first thing, they won't read it if it's in a language they don't understand. Mm-hmm. And most likely, if you provoke them to think about something new, say, for instance, I don't know, we don't get many days to put them out, but let's say, an umbrella. We make umbrellas in this country, for instance, in the garden, but in other countries they don't actually sit in the garden when it's sunny, not because it's too hot, it's just not their culture. Mm-hmm. And we might think, well, it's really sunny, they should buy umbrellas there, shouldn't they? And, you know, that assumption has to be tested before you go down the route of actually trying to sell to these people.
That's such a great example, because it's the sort of thing you could so easily fall into and just not realise that other cultures just view gardens or sitting outside or whatever in a different way. So, David, just to wrap this up, if having listened to this, people are inspired and want to go and do some exporting, where should they start?
Well, I've got to put a plug in for the Department for International Trade. That's, well, we only support UK companies, essentially, but there will be a representative of the Department for International Trade in over 100 countries around the world through the British Embassy. And they are not only there to promote exports from the UK, but they're very interested in promoting the foreign direct investment into the UK. So if anyone is looking to grow their business into the UK, contact with their local embassy, British Embassy, Department for International Trade, and equally their own embassies, their own national embassies, because they'll have their own trade departments too, who can help them find businesses to trade with in the UK. But let's face it, trade makes everyone's lives more economically better. There's no two ways about it. And you know, whilst there may be, it may be seen that some people try to, might be seen as exploiting their, you know, their advantage, to be honest, if we can use our international markets to trade with each other, everyone's life, everyone's economy improves.
David Earp, thank you so much for giving us the benefit of 24 years of experience there in exporting. And if you're interested in the Hofstadter model that David mentioned, Hofstadter is spelt Hofstede, and the model dates back to 2001, and a quick Google will find plenty of examples of people explaining it. David Earp, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Kieran.
The Cambridge Marketing Podcast from Cambridge Marketing College, training marketing and PR professionals across the globe.